Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Welcome, everybody, to Season 4, Episode 5 of The Psychologists Are In. I'm Maggie Lawson.
And I'm her podcast partner in crime, Timothy Ombudson.
And this week, we are joined by executive producer Kelly Kolchak to talk about the incredible episode, Sean Gets the Yips. The one where after a well-known police bar is shot up in an apparent robbery, Sean realizes the shooter was targeting one of the cops, specifically the one who just so happens to be the co-host of this podcast. Also, we love Kelly so much. Enjoy! Kelly, you were, if I remember correctly from the early stories of our like first Steve Franks episode, and like you were the messenger. You were the one that was like, hold, like, here's the idea. You were like, wait, this is good. Hold, yeah, please. Let me go over here and make some shit happen.
Well, Steve came in. It was like my first week on the job, I think, you know, because I'd been working at David Letterman's company. And I feel like when I bring up David Letterman, it's like I'm bringing up Ed Sullivan. It's so long ago. You know,
well, they had the same theater.
Like, people are like, who's David Letterman? Although he's amazing and a national treasure. And yeah. I mean, absolutely. But so I'd been, you know, I left Letterman and sort of like the comfortable job and sort of jumped into running this company, this sort of startup company.
Which was called
Tagline.
Of course. I knew that. I just wanted to share that with the audience.
Yeah. Tagline. And like the first meeting that I had that week was with Steve. And Steve is a feature guy, right? Like he came from features. He dabbled in television, but, you know, he came from features. And so he comes in with like 20 ideas because that's what you do. And it's like, you know, Star Wars meets ordinary people, you know, it's that kind of thing. And he's going down the list.
I love that.
And at the very
script.
End of it, he said, you know, and I have this one idea. It's a television idea. It's a psychic detective who's not really psychic. And I was like, I can sell that. And I knew it. I knew that that elevator pitch, that one-liner would get me in every room. And it did. It was the easiest call to make, to be like, hey, who wants to hear this idea? Like, everybody wanted to hear that idea. Yeah. And you've heard this a million times how, you know, Steve is a giant 6'8" monster. And, you know, these development executives had these little teeny petite rooms. And he was like acting out every scene. And, you know,
wait,
everybody
hold on.
Was like,
no, yeah, we did yeah, not hear thing. Those stories. We heard we've heard like Steve's version, which honestly is kind of everything you just said, which was like you guys had this like pitch meeting and then he was like, you know, I have this other thing, and it was kind of the but I did wait, hold on. Explain the acting out of scenes in the pitches.
Oh, well, you know what, Steve, he directed you guys.
Of course.
You just know.
I know,
so
I just want to hear you tell it.
Everything. I mean, he acted out the entire, and you're in these little teeny. And it was mostly women. It was like, you know, all the heads of development were almost all women, with the exception of USA was the only male that we'd actually pitched to. And, you know, of course, he's 6'8" and he's in these little teeny rooms with these little fluffy pillows and he's like jumping around and you know what I mean? And just
knocking over
like,
potted plants, I assume.
Yes. What do you do with this? And then I think the genius move is when we went to USA, it was a conference room and it was Bill McGoldrick, who we all know and love. And so he had room to sprawl, you know, and, you know, I credit Bill McGoldrick because he was our champion. He was the passionate guy. I thanked him every year when we got picked up because he was the one that bought it and helped keep it alive and was passionate, was a fan. And yeah. It seemed so simple. It was like, oh, we pitched a show. They bought it. We wrote a script. They liked it. They picked it up to series. It broke records. It seemed like this was the greatest first executive producing experience I've ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet it's like a miracle for all of those
things. Oh, it was a miracle. Because I was actually developing a pilot. I had a pilot the same time with Carlos Jaycon at NBC. And so I was producing two pilots at the same time. And let me tell you something, one was Unicorns and Puppies, and that was Psych, and the other one was Hell and Damnation, and that was with Carlos. Nothing to do with, I mean, Carlos's script was brilliant, and it was just, you know, you didn't find the right cast, and it was just, you know, this one was just lightning in a bottle of magic.
Oh, gosh, almost. That's what we always say.
Until we hired Maggie. Then it was lightning in a bottle.
I was about to say, and then it fell apart. No. Oh, Kelly, it's just so good to see you. For like all of our listeners, Kelly has, as you can tell from like just the few seconds she's been on the podcast already, has the most infectious, like, excitement. Like, she pays attention. I remember there'd be times you would come up to me on set, like, in the early days when I was, like, a little, like, timid and not entirely sure what's going on, and you picked up on everything. And you would bring things up to me before I could even be like, am I feeling this way? I'm not really sure. Do I want to bring this up? You'd come over and you'd be like, what's on your mind? Like, she's just had this intuitive way of always knowing what was going on. But then this like childlike excitement, similar to Steve, but like just, you know, the feminine version of that, I guess. That was just like
slightly shorter.
About a foot shorter. What'd you say? A foot shorter?
About a foot shorter, which was nice because I could look Kelly in the eye when she was giving notes.
When I was yelling at you for chewing gum.
Come on, I still say that's what got me the job. My chewing gum beat.
Toothpick. Yeah, I think you had a toothpick. I don't think you were chewing gum when you picked. I think you had a toothpick when you were. Did you have gum when you auditioned, or was it a toothpick?
It was gum. I'm almost positive.
It was gum.
That makes sense. I could totally see that.
Yeah, last year chewing gum, like, which I really wanted to continue. And then Kelly hated this beat of last year chewing gum all the time.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was editing. I would have sit you in an editing room and then try to match your takes whenever you're in between shoes. Okay. And I was just like, what is he doing to us?
Okay.
But you were all about the props. Tim loved. And then we realized, oh, we just give him his gun. That's what makes him happy in every scene. So if we had a gun that he could pull at some point, that's what made Lasseter happy. That's what made Tim happy.
And you made your actor your actor very happy very soon. The holster and the gun. There's prop comedians and a prop actor.
So good. And didn't you guys have to take classes or something to how to hold your gun? Because there's a lot of gunplay in this episode that we're about to talk about. A lot of gunplay.
Major. We actually
did. So good. You got the whole other way. It's so impressive.
We've talked about it quite a bit, just our training. We had a couple of different random experiences training, but we had one that took place in Chilliwack with Clive,
Involved a very expensive traffic ticket.
Traffic ticket that we have talked about a lot on this podcast.
For Margaret Cassidy Lawson.
The sweet officer said, I want to let you guys go, but you were actually going so fast. I can't.
I will never forget Maggie echoing, oh yeah, that's way too fast.
There was no way around it. I was going too fast. But anyway, yes, Kelly, to answer your question, we had quite a bit of training actually. And a lot of, you know, I mean, for us, I always loved the amount of care around the safety, gun safety on our show. It was like,
you know, so when we get to that gun range, Clive opens up a duffel bag of weapons. And as awesome as Maggie Lawson is, if you have not seen Maggie shoot a sawed-off pistol grip shotgun, then you all are missing out because somebody goes a little hardcore.
Look, I was in character.
Yeah.
And I was trying to be as believable as possible. And that day I was, you know, I stepped into a little method acting, I think.
Wait a minute, was that the sorority house episode, right? That you had the shotgun? Was that the one?
Mina, it's the third Yang. I believe. Right. Is it the third one? Yeah, because the second one is Hitchcock and Mr. Yin Presents. And right. then the third one, I have the battle with Mina Suvari, round one.
I thought it was one of the movies.
No, the battle with Mina, the first battle with Allison Cali, your wife's the character name for your wife, is in the third of the Yang trilogy in the series, which is why she comes back for revenge in the first movie. Yeah. So, but that moment was joyful for me.
And it showed, but that was not a sawed-off shotgun. That was a full barrel.
That was a full shotgun, yeah.
Because it was the awesome one-headed rack. You get in that one.
Yeah. Was just
sublime.
I remember James coming up and saying to me, "Are you comfortable with this? Like, do you think you can do it with one hand?"
And he said, "Watch this."
I remember just looking at him and being like,
"What?
Did you really just ask me that?" No.
I don't know if you know this, but I'm Maggie Lawson.
Come on. This is very funny. I love that we are off on this topic. Kelly, yes. Yes, we did. We absolutely, we did training because there was a lot. Oh my gosh, the shootout. I mean, we'll get to the episode. I was with you. I wrote down like the major gunplay in this episode, which was actually really very well choreographed and very cool. I thought.
Oh, that's my professional notes too. My professional notes is there's something about massive gunplay.
These are my professional notes. Yes. Kelly, wait. So I want to hear if you remember anything, if you remember I feel like I would have so many questions about episodes where you had to either fight for stuff, Nick's stuff, you know, someone loved, like all those hard things. Yes, Tim.
Sorry. Before we hop into questions for Kelly.
Yes.
Which is a great part of another amazing segment of the show. Questions for Kelly.
Oh, yes, of course. Of course.
But I have a statement about Kelly. So I remember, Kelly, when I first met you after the audition, which, by the way, I thought you were the casting director walking. I didn't know who you were. I didn't know who the casting director was. I mean, I'd never met the casting director before. So to see this awesome, powerful woman sitting at the table, I'm thinking, well, that's got to be the casting director. But after I got the job, I remember being at LAX and seeing you at LAX because we were both flying up to Vancouver, obviously, to shoot our television show, and running into you in the bar, in one of the bars in LAX, sitting down having a beer with you, and like basically going, okay, who the hell are you? What's your story? And you told me like your pedigree of places you had worked, like all the shows you'd worked on Fox. I was like, oh, okay, this woman knows what she's doing. Sign me up. That was you have a very impressive resume, my friend.
Oh. Yeah.
And you brought all that awesomeness and incredible talent and knowledge to our little show and made it so much better.
I agree. I remember too. I remember being like a little intimidated to meet you just because of your I was like, oh my gosh, we're in Kelly Kolchak or whatever. And I think that was another part of it. Like you're the most disarming, like fun, approachable, like none of the, all those things that you might have in your head about, like, I'm nervous to meet somebody, you literally put out immediately upon meeting you. Like, the greatest.
I was just starstruck. I really was. Tim, obviously, you know, we were huge Deadpool fans. Not Deadpool, Deadwood fans. And so, you know what I mean? It was just like, and both of you brought such incredible, unique takes to the role. I mean, we just knew instantly when we saw you guys. It was like, yes, and yes. There was no doubt about it of how talented and amazing you were. And I have to say, I think the success of any of us is that if you start to become cynical and lose your love for this business and lose, you know, working around incredible talent and just sort of what a gift that is, you know, you should check out because this is such a magical, magical world that you've got to have some sort of joy to step into it and keep it relevant. And I think that's why, you know, Steve is so fantastic because he always comes from a place of passion, you know, and goodness. Yeah. There's such, he's so good.
You said the right word though.
Yeah.
Because you and Steve are the opposite of cynical.
Yeah.
Like you were the polar opposite of that word.
Yeah, there's like an innocent, I just said the word wonder because I feel like that makes it, there is still a discovery, joy,
joyful enthusiasm is what I would go with.
Enthusiasm, all those things, absolutely. And that's the, that was the thing. Like even on days I was my most nervous on those first like few episodes, I was sort of stepping into this new cast and the, you know, who all kind of knew each other a little bit. You were there. And I remember you just were, everybody did it. Everybody was a little bit like different. Like there was a way we were all kind of used to doing things. And it was like, wow, this is special. This feels different. Not that any of that was bad. It just was more like there was just something was happening and everybody was on the same page.
You may have had
a way of doing things, Maggie, but I think this is one of my first pilots I ever did. So I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Right.
I was such a rookie in terms of getting like serious contract work.
Yeah.
So you may have said this different. I was like, I'm just happy to be here and I don't know what the hell is going on.
And you could tell. That's what I mean. We were all kind of in the same place of just like, and you know, I think we still have it. I think all of us still have that same, like, as you said, I don't know that anybody's taken any sort of cynical, I mean, I do know, like no one has taken a cynical turn even in all of the things that have happened. It's really something.
Totally agree.
That's so lucky. Wait, we have to like do our little intro. First off, Kelly, you look amazing. Tim, you look insane. We look good. And Tim, I have to ask you, are you ready to podcast the shit out of it?
Maggie Lawson, I am so ready to podcast the shit out of it because we have our dear friend Kelly Kolchak here. Finally, we got Kelly to play with us.
Kelly, are you ready to podcast the shit out of it?
I am ready. Absolutely.
You guys. We've actually been podcasting the shit out of it for a little while, but we didn't do our like normal little intro. So we're going to give you guys that and we'll launch into the episode. But I still, Kelly, I can't imagine, and this might just be the first of many you have to do so that you can tell all of these stories. But like, you know, you had a hard job because you would know like Steve's in love with an idea. James is in love with an idea. Like, and then you'd also have the network being like, no way in hell, or that's too expensive. Or like, and you have, you know, you and Chris and having to deal with going back and forth. And that's, I was going to ask you if you had any absolute heartbreak stories that you were like, oh man, I cannot believe I have to go back and say they can't do this right now. Or anything that you were like, oh, this was the worst position to be in. Because it was tricky, especially in this episode. This episode has a lot of guns. I would imagine there were probably parts of this too on the other side when it was being pitched or whatever that you're like, how are we going to get away with this?
It was a new director for our show.
What's that?
It was a new director for our show. Tanya never done
an episode of ours.
Yeah. But she has great, she came from great genes because she's, I think, Stephen Kyle's kid, right? Like,
she is.
You know, I don't think that gunplay or that action was foreign to her in any way, shape, or form. She came to play for sure. I think the hardest part for the network and for us actually was the coverage that she did in the restaurant when Lassiter starts trying to shoot at that guy, you know, the bad guy in the beginning. And I think that we were like, wow, there's a lot of rounds being fired. I thought he was a better shot than that. You know what I mean? Because he doesn't make it dead. And I think
I had
we were
two
like,
nine millimeters.
We got to pull that back.
I emptied two clips into this that side of the restaurant. And even though I was like,
there was a
the
lot.
Guy comes in and was like, what is he doing? Like, he shows, you know, Lassiter doesn't see a weapon. He just sees a figure and Sean says there's a bad guy here. And Lassiter immediately pulls out two handguns and empties both clips into the wall. Bad cop work.
Into a crowded restaurant. It was. There was a lot of back and forth on that. That's for sure.
Restaurant, for sure. Yeah. I could totally see
and,
that.
And I think for good reason. But you know, the thing about it is, and the thing that we always could pull is that this is a heightened comedic drama, right?
Yeah.
Like things are, to say the least. So you always had a little bit of wiggle room where you could do something that felt a little bigger than normal. But I think it was hard because I would always argue from a character standpoint, you know, I don't want to hit that guy, you know, and they're like, no, it's funnier if he doesn't. And, you know, obviously the story can't happen if he does hit him.
Right.
So we got to move forward. So yeah, that was probably the biggest thing that Steve and I and the writers always the best discussion that we would have. Because right. I would always try to go for dramatic and real and whatever. And it would always get thrown out the window if there was a comedy. It's just like, it's a comedy. And they were right. 99% of the time, they were right that we have to lean into the comedy because that's what makes the show so unique, right? It wasn't even a dramedy. It was a comedra, I would say.
A comedra, I never heard that term before.
Comedra. I haven't even heard that. And I
love it. You just made up a new phrase that we've never heard.
I know. Guys, did you hear it? You're hearing it on The Psychologists Are In first. This is an exclusive.
So in the 90s, there were a lot of dramedies. This was a comedrama. Is that what you just said?
Comedrama.
It was a comedrama. It was much more comedy than it was drama. It didn't start out, well, that's not true. The pilot had more dramatic moments in it than the series did because you had his issues with his dad, you know, yep. At some point they thought they were responsible for some guy being dead, you know, at it, you know, there was a lot more to it and emotion to it. And then, you know, you find the show as you go. I think you find that series and you both have been on different series. You find it like not in the second or third episode, but like 5 and 6 are like the magic to be like, this is it. This is the tone. This is what we're going for. I think even for you as actors, I'll bet your character, you slip into, oh, now I know how this works and how does this play, where the nuances
are.
Well,
we know with Maggie, it was when she put on the heels and I put on the shoulder holster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I started to actually feel, I remember at first even being, and I've talked about this on here, just being like, I'm wearing a suit. I'm a serious detective. I'd like come off of a couple of comedies and I was 25, 26 and stuff. And I was like, man, I'm going to have to like really start getting used to this. And then you're right. It was sort of like midway through season 1 where I started to feel like, oh, right. This is now I don't feel like Juliet unless I'm wearing a suit.
Sorry. And also your default naturally is effervescence and joy and sunshine. So to suddenly have to be like that tough cop gal.
Which I love.
Required this thing called acting.
Which we got to do in this one.
Oh, yeah. There was some tough cop stuff in this one, for sure.
Should we dive in, you guys?
Yeah, but Kelly, I have a new title for Kelly. Rather than just executive producer, I'd say Kelly was chief cat wrangler.
that's a very good title. I'll take it.
We saw a kitty just walk through, actually.
I know.
Speaking of cats. Oh, by the way.
Yeah. Hi, Maggie. Hi, Tim. Hi, Kelly. All right.
Maggie. Oh, we were twinsing and I took off my hat.
Yeah. You took off. Oh, yeah. Do you have your psychology? Yay.
I was thinking, I was showing my gray to, in solidarity with Kelly's amazing silver.
Gorgeous
head of hair.
Yeah. Gorgeous room. Okay, let's dive into the episode, you guys, and then chime in with your memories, notes, or anything fun. Okay, this is episode 5. Sean Gets the Yips, written by Kel Cahoon and Bill Callahan, directed by Tanya McKiernan. All right. Okay. Oh, I did get one of these. Wow. There's a couple of pineapple sightings. Okay, pineapple sighting. Tim, did you get?
I'm going to say no.
I
don't even bother looking anymore. I'm just too busy enjoying the episodes.
Because Devin will find it for us. Okay. On Gus's nightstand, there is a pineapple behind his alarm clock. I saw that. And there is a pineapple on a tombstone in the graveyard. Devin, good eye. Whoa.
That's impressive.
That is some hardcore pineapple sighting, Devin.
That's some good sleuthing. Okay. Cold open. It's 1989. Henry sets up a shooting target poster with a catcher's mitt carefully pinned on top. He teaches Sean about the most important rule of playing second base, which is the footwork. After perfectly completing his first move, Henry teaches Sean a new move, where Sean throws the ball perfectly into Henry's car windshield. Cut to present time.
This was well after, I believe, Corbin had starred in Major League 2, right?
Yes.
Just the baseball synchronicity.
Synchronicity right there. Cut to present time. Sean and the gang are out celebrating an SBPD softball game victory at a well-known cop bar, which I thought was just, I loved this about us anyway. I thought this was such a cute little bonding thing. Sean mentions he has the yips, but Lassie retorts back, It's called The Sucks.
Should be called The Sucks.
It should be called The Sucks, which I wrote down. Why has this not become more like we have like, I'd rather shower with a bear. We have like a lot of Lassieisms, but this, it should be called The Sucks, in my opinion, is one of the most classic Lasseter lines ever. I thought
it was great. It's the greatest bonus of having Cal Calhoun and Bill Callahan, who both cut their teeth on half hour, nine jokes a page comedy. They just brought it to this episode. I mean, really brought it. They did a great job.
There was a lot of very dry humor in it. Tim.
Yeah.
What?
I was giving a beatnik snap for Kel and Bill.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Exactly. Kel and Bill.
So good. Such good writers.
Sean asked the waitress for his pizza, chili, cheese fries, a.k.a. the Sean Spencer. The gang are also celebrating McNabb's birthday. So cute. But as the waiters bring out his cake, Sean spots a hooded man by the register with a bulge in his jacket. He runs over to Lassie for help, but Lassie keeps singing Happy Birthday, which I got to stop you.
I got to interrupt you. When it's close-up shadow Dulé hitting that first happy note, which brings – we've told the Happy Birthday story on this podcast before, right?
We can tell it again because I wrote it down too. I was like, this is just such a funny thing because this is exactly how it went in real life, always. With the long ha.
Yeah, it's when there was a guest star that we loved or someone in particular we loved and they were wrapped, we would sing Happy Birthday. And it always happened with, it started with Marco Ciccone, usually hitting that first note of that big elongated ha, and then we'd all know. And then the entire crew would join in this, which I gotta say, our mutual friend Rob Benedict has heard me tell the story many times. And he always goes, I never got the Happy Birthday when I rapped.
That's funny.
So it wasn't always for everyone that we loved, but in particular, but it took me back when seeing Dulé hit that opening note in this particular scene really made me go, oh, that's our show. That's our episode. I mean, that's what we do.
There's a crazy nostalgia in that for us.
And I think, and you probably know this because you've been on enough shows. I look at it as a producer where I went, oh, are we actually singing Happy Birthday? That's so expensive because it used to be. Like $150,000 for that song. But then there was, I think, obviously,
public domain because or something.
We used it and we sang it a couple of times in this. It went into public domain. So we didn't have to pay for it anymore. So you should just see an entire group of shows.
Was it now public domain? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Crazy. We sang it all the time on set.
I know.
That's when Sean mentions a loaded gun. Lassie tells Sean to move, grabs his two guns, and begins a shoot off. Only for the perp to run off. Kelly is already laughing.
Faherty is a family brand founded by Alex, his wife Carrie, and his twin brother Mike that channels their love of the beach lifestyle into clothing for life's greatest moments. Faherty is passionate about craftsmanship, comfort, and sustainability. Their ongoing partnership with Native designers supports Native communities while helping end appropriation in fashion. Every piece is designed to be a lifetime favorite, and if anything happens along the way, Faherty will replace or fix your clothes for a life. No matter what. Layer up this winter with their best-selling Legend sweater shirts for men, women, and kids, recycled high-pile fleece jackets, and new Frost sweaters. I love this brand so much. I feel like even over time, it gets better. It starts to feel like it was made for you. I am completely obsessed. It's like super easy, laid back, that sort of beachy feeling they talk about, but it looks really good. And it kind of just like highlights all your best features. I'm telling you, you guys, I love it. And also you can just tell it's so well made. Faherty is giving all Psychologists Are In listeners an amazing deal. 20% off your order. Did you hear that? Head to FahertyBrand.com/Maggie and use code Maggie at checkout to get this deal. That's code Maggie at Faherty, F-A-H-E-R-T-Y brand.com/Maggie for 20% off. FahertyBrand.com/Maggie.
I have a photo of this somewhere with it's one of my favorite pictures. It's the most one of the most quintessential Lasseter pictures I have in my hard drive somewhere. Lasseter holding both his Glocks and the flame shooting out because when you fire a gun, obviously there's a flame that comes out.
The
muzzle flash, as they call it technically. Yeah. So cool. two gun Lasseter here.
Two gun Lasseter. Doesn't hit him. doesn't hit anything. Thank
misses,
God.
Misses totally, just breaks all the windows. Somehow doesn't notes. Kill a civilian.
I have notes. Kelly, I have notes.
And then the chief shows up, and I'm not suspended for this gross dereliction of duty.
Right.
It's like, because it's the comedy.
It's a comedra.
It's a comedra.
It's a comedra. Yeah. And by the way, Kirsten, come on. Can we just take a moment? I'm so, talk about a girl crush. She is just the best.
Very crushable.
Talk about herding cats. Like always trying to keep control of the craziness that's going around her. And she just crushes it. She's amazing.
Still Kirsten does. Was just playing you.
Still does. Oh, I know. Basically. I know.
Yeah, she's playing
Kelly. We got to point out the rocked collar, the popped rocked collar.
Always.
In a black, in a totally non-color, she's wearing a black blouse with the collars out to here, looking awesome as she always does.
Yeah.
Perfect.
She looks perfect. She looks fantastic. And she does just come in and like takes control. Yeah. Okay, the cops think it was an attempted robbery, but Sean says the man came there specifically to kill one of them. Back at the police station, Sean mentions he thinks the shooter will try again, but if they can figure out which one of them was the target, it will give them a clue to the man's identity. Henry then storms into the station, making sure Sean is all right and nagging him on why he didn't pick up his phone. Sean says it was because he was eating a banana, but he at least thought of his dad because he's his big Papa Bear monkey. Wait, that was the cutest.
Yeah, not. Thing. But you miss. Yeah, he goes. You're my big papa monkey. Where, in our text thread, we always call Corbin. Corbin's nickname for us is Papa Bear. So I thought it was kind of a synchronistic-ish moment. Where
that
he says,
is what you call
big
him.
Old papa monkey.
And also, his Corbin's delivery was you ate a banana. Corbin's delivery of you ate a banana was one of my favorite things. When Dulé says or Gus says, yes, he ate a banana. He's like, you ate a banana. Oh, it's very good.
We always said we love the idea that everybody's in a drama, but Sean and Gus are in a comedy. And that's what made it perfect, is that everything that they say is ridiculous and hilarious. And the people around them are just like, you ate a banana. It's like, they're not going to get it. They're just not going to get it.
Hang on. Kelly, that was such an amazing point. You've got to repeat that.
Oh, that Sean and Gus were in a comedy and everybody else was in a drama?
Yeah, I mean, that is some incredible insider right there, kids.
Yeah, that is actually no one has said that, but that is exactly that is true. We were all in a drama.
Yeah,
they were in a comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, speaking of comedy, I wrote down there's like, so the chief, chief comes in and she's the restaurant. I was like, are all these people still in the restaurant eating? Just waiting. Like I wrote down restaurant business as usual. Meanwhile, the windows are like shot out. The chief is there. We're like, you know, she's like, okay, we need to interview everybody who was here. And I'm like, okay, so we just kept everyone here because this is obviously a crime scene. But if you look in the background, everyone's just sort of business as usual. Like we're having a grand old time.
Picking broken glass out of their salads.
Yes, picking broken glass out of their salads.
Because last year just shattered glass everywhere.
It was actually kind of funny. Okay. Chief Vic introduces a psychologist that the cops can speak to after their traumatic event at the bar. And Sean pulls her aside. Yes.
Okay. So we're back to the SBPD.
Yes.
Lassiter, for some reason, is still in his softball uniform.
Yes.
For so long.
And O'Hara is in, you're wearing a lovely sweater that is Lawson Lilac.
Lawson Lilac for a while, actually.
But you're wearing the sweet one, the whole episode.
I like Lawson Lilac.
I will tell you the most fun and depressing moment was at the end of the series. We got to go into wardrobe. I hope USA is listening. We got into wardrobe and we were like, oh, we get to it. I was like, I'm going to go. I love everything that Maggie, nothing fit. Everything I put in, I was like, oh, she's a size -4. This works.
Oh my God, please stop it.
I did snag one of your rain jackets.
And oh, the I had good rain jackets.
Dulé's Hogwarts robes that you wore. Still in my closet. Love it.
Oh,
that was my
that
very amazing.
So good.
It was legit. It was a legit robe.
That's so good. It's so funny. Yeah. I didn't take too many things, although I do wear my trench coat in this one. At the end, it was funny. I remember like talking about it with everybody and being like, we got a few things that we loved that were like, you know, very special and sentimental.
Wait, Maggie, did you snag that short black trench coat?
Did I?
The one you're wearing for that second half of the episode, did that fall off a truck?
I think I did. It's very cool, but I didn't take it.
Because that one was That was particularly cool coat. Because it's longer than our regular trench that we, our regular raincoats we wear.
It's very, very, very cool. It's just always interesting because I'm like, man, that feels like Juliet. So like, I love all my clothes, but I also know if I put them on.
What you wear helps you perform. Is that really true? Like if you know, it sort of makes you feel like, no, I'm really playing the detective right here.
That's when I feel like I'm in. You go hair, you go makeup, and then you come in. You put on the wardrobe. For me, I stepped into the heels. I'm like, okay, now I feel like.
Now the English actors would call that an outside-in technique.
Oh, versus an inside-out. You're fancy, Tim.
So I get to say
you must have gone to school for this.
Now, in I'm going to go so wonky here. In Olivier's biography, which of course I read.
Of course you did. A couple times.
Confessions of an Actor. He used to say that when he knew how a character walked backwards in his shoes, that's how he knew he got the character.
Oh, wow.
Which is, you know, Larry knew what he was doing.
Yeah. I love that.
He also used to get nervous, so nervous he would throw up before every performance on stage.
Who?
Wow.
Larry Olivier.
Really?
Yeah. Which, speaking of me in that softball uniform, something was rather uncomfortable thing for me to wear, because I mean I like the suits to cover everything up and make me feel a little more shoulder padded up, and so to be basically in like a long sleeve t-shirt, and we've talked about helmets and stick arms, the fact that I was in that baseball shirt the entire episode was,
you look great,
horrifying to me.
You look amazing.
You're so kind. You know what? I should have done what again my good friend Larry Olivier did. Olivier was so nervous about his skinny leg, his stick legs. He used to wear padded tights.
What? Really?
Yeah, because he did so much Shakespeare. He was always in tights. So he would wear like calf muscle pads and thigh. I should have put on some shoulder pads under that.
No, you look fantastic.
And some butt pads too, because I'm also in those pants, those baseball pants, which I did not quite fill out the way some of the other actors on our show filled out.
And I think what this is so important for people to hear, because people look at actors and think, you must feel you're so perfect because you're so beautiful and so handsome and whatever. It's like, there's a part of all of us that has that imposter syndrome, right? Like, oh, people are going to find me out because I've got thin arms. I don't think, it's so funny. If only you could see yourself as other people do, it would be the biggest gift in the world, because our anxieties and our fears and our self-doubts, you would just have such a different perspective. Because
as if my whole life was my Instagram page.
You're perfect.
You're so sweet, Kelly.
You know, funny you mentioned that, Kelly, because when we had those drinks in that bar at LAX, and I was learning how amazingly awesome you are, one of the conversations we had was about my weight, because I brought it up. And I was saying how I was trying to not drink too much beer, because it makes my, I carry the weight in my face. Beer or burgers. We were talking about something came about food and weight.
Yeah.
And you very kindly were like, you're so skinny. And I was like, no, of course not. But now, because I look back at these episodes and I say this to my teenage daughters who, you know, look at Instagram like every young kid does and they feel bad about themselves. And I say, you know what? I look back at pictures from psych and I was always so concerned about what I looked like, my weight and everything, because I'm a vain actor of nothing. Now I look back and go, my God, I was so skinny. I actually had cheekbones there and a bit of a jawline, even in this episode.
It's so funny. I kind of do the same thing, Tim, where like I look back and I just think of all of the things I worried about, all of the things I felt insecure about. And that's, I mean, I still have that fraud kind of imposter thing, Kelly. Like, you know, but it is crazy, you know, because I think of how much time we spend in that space, in that headspace of like, you know, concern, worry, or insecurity maybe about, you know, and you know, when you're on camera and wardrobe and all of that, you're always checking kind of everything, because you're fully on display all the time, right?
So Maggie, thought you were going to say, you look back at the episodes and think, how amazing Tim looked.
Oh, that's the other thing, sure. I think.
Speaking of softball, I just lobbed you a softball.
And I hit it out of the park. Speaking of softball, here. Let's go back to the yips.
Yips.
Wait. Hang on. Chief Fake introduces the psychologist. The cops speak to after their traumatic event at the bar, and Sean pulls her aside, asking if he'd use a different psychologist, specifically a sports psychologist, to help with his yips. McNabb reveals that the crime scene unit found a piece of the man's hooded sweatshirt and a motel key in the alley behind the bar. It looks like his pocket ripped as he was fleeing the scene. Lassiter and Juliet head to the motel while Sean and Gus go back to the bar. While there, Sean remembers the shooter was wearing an expensive watch, which proves he wasn't a junkie thief. Sean mentions his socks were also $80 since he just got them with Gus's Nordstrom's card.
And in that motel, Lassiter and O'Hara bust in the motel room, full cop gear, guns out.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of badassness in this.
We were watching the pilot, which of course, sadly, Maggie was not a part of. Boo. There was a scene when I think Lucinda Barrios comes around a corner with like full arms extended for those of you who are not watching in the Patreon video. And it's like such bad gun technique, especially for a cop. So, because that immediately, well, like,
it was the I'm pilot. Always, I'm always sure there was hyper. No training.
This is why I kept like pushing for us to get gun training.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't have known anything had I not had, like, I mean, we had quite a bit. And we'd even practice sometimes. Like, the professional way to do all of that is to sweep a room is no joke.
And I love the fact that Maggie, that you leaned into it, because there's nothing worse than when people are like, nah, she's just a girl with a gun. And you're like, that girl's got to be pro. She's got to be downright badass. You carry it. So that's Tim. But Maggie
was like, hey, let me hand me that pistol grip shotgun, would you? Let me try that sucker. Kaboom.
Let me try that one.
Kablammy.
Okay. As Gus heads back to the car, Sean realizes that the shooter was deliberately standing in the blind spot of the security cameras. The shooter is much smarter than they gave him credit for, which means that the key was planted to lure the cops to the motel. Sean recreates the shooting scene by using salt for himself, pepper for Gus, sugar for Juliet, a lemon for Lassiter, and a cherry for McNabb. Sean then times the shooter's movements to the time frame of the song Happy Birthday and realizes the target is Lassiter. Sean calls to warn Lassiter, who is on his way back from finding nothing at the motel. As Lassiter leans down to pick up the phone from the floorboard of his car, a shot comes through his window. This was crazy.
I got to point out that phone.
Yeah.
So Lassiter was rocking a BlackBerry there.
I know.
This was the early days of when we all have BlackBerries.
Yeah.
I love my BlackBerry.
I need to bring up the point about Maggie Lawson. Maggie Lawson is the reason I finally had to get a smartphone. Because back in the early days in season one, I was still, I mean, we're not doing season one now, but early days I had like a Nokia flip phone. And Maggie really only communicates by text. Still to this day, it's pretty much either a voice text.
Yes, she should.
We almost never speak on the phone.
So I know, my phone rings and I'm like, oh, it's an emergency.
It took me like 20 minutes to text a simple thing of like where we were going for drinks to Maggie. So I was like, I got to get a smartphone.
Yeah. No, I made you get a smartphone.
And I think I went to a BlackBerry first.
Because BlackBerry was like the ease of use of a BlackBerry before the iPhone that we had that kind of more user-friendly way to go. There was like the Palm Trio. There were a bunch of these smartphones, but like the BlackBerry was just so easy. It just had the text down immediately, the email down immediately. Like it was easy to browse.
Yeah,
oh, man,
it's great.
Listen to me.
I still have a shoebox full of like BlackBerries in my office that I need to sell or do something with.
I wonder if like some of the psychos are like listening to this right now and they're like, what the hell is a BlackBerry? Was that a car on site?
BlackBerry.
Yeah.
Ancient
it's very
text.
Funny. Yeah.
And it made me feel like a TV executive. It seemed like that's what all the executives always use BlackBerries so they could type.
Yeah. Well, there was also like an email thing about the BlackBerry that the iPhone, like none of those had yet. That was just, it was like one button, all your emails. It was easy.
Yeah. Then it totally, and this is sort of the destruction of our society, it made it so that you worked 24/7. You couldn't get away from it because your emails were right here. It was really hard. It was really hard, but delightful because you didn't have to be back in the office to return an email. That was also like great. So
that's true. But it changed everything.
Or I could be wrapped and walking in the car on the way home and quickly text Mags where we were going for drinks, or asking her where we were going for drinks.
See?
Which is all we ever text the other
one. It's joyous. It's joyous.
Where are we going for drinks?
In addition to...
I'd be like, Tim, what are you doing with your hair? It looks amazing. You're incredible. That's all we did. That's all
I
we
love
did.
This team.
Unless I was like,
I'm... people wonder why we're friends.
Yeah. I'd also be like, Tim, let's go shopping. James would be like, Tim, let's go watch a game at Joey's. And you'd be like, I'm going to go shopping with Maggie. Anyway.
I still remember one of my favorite days with you was coming out of walking out of Holt Renfrew, which was the kind of a fancy department store right near the Sutton Place Hotel.
Yeah.
And I was wearing these. When I discovered Rag and Bone.
Rag and Bone.
And I was wearing these sort of blue-gray Rag and Bone trousers, and you just stopped and went, what are those? And I was like, I guess I'm buying these.
You know who we can thank for Rag and Bone? Mr. Chris Henze.
Well, Chris, of course. Chris Henze, the style guru.
The style guru was like Rag and Bone, Rag and Bone, Rag and Bone, everything Rag and Bone. And I was like, what is this Rag and Bone? And then it was all Rag and Bone from that point forward.
Yeah. Mr. Untuck It, that was one of our first. He's the man that developed the Untuck It shirt. I swear to God.
And really?
A store out there. Yeah, that was the big thing from the pilot. It was that he would untuck his. It was like half tuck, right? It was like half tuck.
I think we called it the Hollywood tuck.
The Hollywood tuck. That's the Hollywood tuck, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
I think that's what Stephen Yips called it when we interviewed them.
No, that is what that's what's called, the Hollywood tuck. And it's so funny because I'm remembering this now too, Kelly, where I was like, that looks cool.
That is Henze. He is
looks cooler than everybody. Yes.
Yeah. Always. But I think it's because he hung out with a lot of fancy feature people, and they were always on the cutting edge of what was cool. And he just like, but I think he's always had it. He has such great taste. I mean, that's the secret sauce of Chris Henze, is that he can look at something and be like, this is how it should look, and this is what it should be. And he's just such a great curator of that, I think.
Yeah.
It's funny. For years, so Allison, much. When I would tuck in my shirts, Allison would make fun of, I was doing the tucky tuck as opposed to the Hollywood tuck. It's like, it just basically looks like such a nerd with my shirts tucked in.
I still love, the Hollywood tuck is still my go-to. I don't want to fully tuck. I don't want to be that structured, but I don't want the shirt hanging out. You want a little shape, but like still be cool and relaxed. It's all because of Henze.
It's all because of Henze.
It should be getting some kind of royalty. Yeah. All right. Okay. Where were we?
It's the first time in the episode that Sean saves my life.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And again, what horrible, horrible driving that I get distracted by my phone, literally let go of the wheel, reach across the floorboard into the passenger seat floorboard. It's like, no wonder you crashed his car. Granted, you're shot and distracted. But.
No, but I love the misdirect that you're dead.
Yeah.
But it comes back that you're just like, oh my God. And it's your car that you're upset about. You're fine.
Yeah.
You're fine. By the way, that
just
car
got
went
it
right
back.
Into a pole.
He just got it back from the shop.
You're fine. Car.
Okay, back at the police station, Lassiter is unharmed but infuriated. He says a lot of people want to kill him, and he takes great pride in that. Lassie wants to put away whoever tried to kill him, but Chief Vic takes him off the case and puts him on a 24-hour watch at the police station. Sean mentions the frozen yogurt guy is out front, asking if he wanted to get some, and then jokes that, oh, wait, you can't. Lassiter then throws his shoe at him. This was the cutest, most childish, wonderful moment. One of my favorite between the two of you ever. Sean, Gus, and Juliet decide that whoever's trying to target Lassiter is more likely someone he put in jail. As they're searching through old convicts' files, Lassie keeps chiming in from the lockdown room, so cute, trying to be involved. The gang then shift to the psych office, and Juliet asks who the elliptical belongs to, only for Sean to say, take a look at our bodies and judge for yourself.
This is such a great beat.
So Jules asks Gus where he got it. Burn.
Such a good, funny beat.
I love that beat too. Juliet also mentioned she joined a gym and started a great motivation regime with a trainer, and he offers to teach Sean some tricks. He declines, saying he's not much for Tony Robbins motivational speeches, but he's more a fan of his brother, Baskin.
Yeah. That was a funny joke.
Come on.
This show is like funny, you guys.
College, but I don't know who pitched that in the room, but it does feel like.
It's good. It's so good. Back at the station, Lassney snoops around on his computer and begins calling past suspects, claiming they're responsible for his attempted murder. Back at the office, Sean realizes that their suspect is a local drug lord named Ivan Petrovich. At the station, Juliet tells Chief Vic who their perp is and secretly has Lassie listening on speakerphone. Lassiter reveals that McNabb was with him too when he arrested Petrovich, so he may be in danger as well. McNabb is then put under a 24-hour watch, but after quickly checking his mailbox first, I remember this day, it explodes, sending him flying into the pool. Chief Vic is worried that everyone involved with the case is in danger, including Sean and Gus, who were listed as consultants. Yes.
A fun moment before that, before Sage goes to his mailbox.
Yeah.
You try to buzz him in, then you go to his gate when you don't get him, and you start to climb over the gate.
I know.
Then he shows up, and he just like reaches out and unflicks it. Like, it's totally, it was just a latch. He just does a quick latch and opens the gate. But for some reason, O'Hara is such a badass. She's going to let some lock gate stop her. She starts to go over the gate.
I didn't even try the latch, though. Come on. By the way, try it.
Actually, the network was that McNabb was dead. Come on. That killed him, right? That there's no way that he survived from that, because he gets blown up like 30 feet over into the pool.
Lands in the pool.
But that amazing waterworks shot in the pool with the flames as our snow performer falls back into the water. That's some badass action work right there. Again,
that was amazing. That was amazing.
Tanya's lineage of working for growing up in the canal world.
Right.
That day, that stunt was incredible to watch. Like, I remember we were out, it was an apartment building in White Rock, and we were all kind of nearby. We all watched it. It was really elaborate and wild. It looked so good. Like the way that it was shot, I thought it was a really, really, really good one for us.
Okay. Right, after you're in my experience with fire on the show, the fact that you stuck around and watched that stunt happen.
It was very
again,
cool.
That just shows how badass and dedicated you are.
Oh yeah, that was probably after our Earth, Wind, and Fire. Earth, Wind, and Wait for It.
Wait for it.
Yes. Okay. Gus runs to the psych office where he finds Sean running on an elliptical with a note saying, "If your heart rate drops under 150, you die." I'm already laughing. Gus calls the police, but it turns out that the note was just written by Juliet, who was trying to motivate him, and the beeping sound was just their lost phone.
Their exchange about Lethal Weapon was in Danny Glover being stuck in the toad was very funny.
Yes. So good. Sean and Gus visit the police station, but hide behind Jules' car and drop in fear once a sprinkler goes off, thinking it's Petrovich attacking them. Once the two make it inside the station, they run into McNabb, whose right eyebrow is blown right off. He even mentions he's missing parts of his toes. And he also has a concussion. But
I gotta say, Sage is so funny in this scene. Like his
so funny
big old Labrador puppy joyfulness truly comes out. And I mean, the dialogue was obviously great. But Sage just knocked it out of the park.
It's so good. He's very, 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 very funny. And without effort, he's just playing McNabb. It's so good. He mentions that he's missing parts of his toes and all of that. But when he hears a tickle in Sean's throat, he goes, "Here I am complaining about this when you're dying of thirst."
Just it's remember. So good. Sage is a part of our show because he raised his hand in the pilot to say that he believed that Sean was psychic. That was the moment
we need him.
That was improvised. That
really, I didn't know that.
That's a guy.
I didn't know that, Kelly. Awesome. In all the stories we've told, no one told that story.
100%. The guy behind the bar was supposed to raise his hand, but Sage raised his hand, and I know that Steve was like, "Oh, that's some good comedy instinct right there." I believe that's true.
Oh, I love it. Even if it's not, it's staying as the truth for us.
I remember the little teeny things.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I don't know about you guys, but I certainly wish that life came with a user manual. I mean, I feel like all of us can relate to that on
some level. But unfortunately, life doesn't. So when it is not working for you, it is normal to feel stuck. Navigating any of life's challenges can make you feel unsure, whether it's a career change, a new relationship, or becoming a parent. Therapists are trained to help you figure out the cause of challenging emotions and learn productive coping skills, which makes therapy the closest thing to a guided tour of the complex engine called you. BetterHelp has connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists. It is convenient and accessible anywhere and 100% online. I had such an easy, wonderful, safe experience with BetterHelp. From downloading the app to tailoring the entire experience just for you and your needs and what you want, and to make you feel safe, which honestly, I feel like is the best way to get what you need to get out of therapy, is you have to have and feel like you are in a safe environment. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. Really, it couldn't. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/pineapple. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pineapple. Okay, Sean mentions he had a vision about an old drug front that Petrovich used to use. Sean, Gus, Juliet, and Lassiter rush there, where Sean reveals a secret door in the basement.
Sorry, yes. I got to go back. So we're back in the SPPD, right?
We are right before we go to. Okay.
You've changed your civvies. You are back in your lost in lilac.
I'm in lilac.
And Lassiter finally puts on a suit, which I was so happy again, because I've never discussed why I was so happy not to be showing my stick arms and have a suit. But I'm not just in my gray suit. I'm in a red tie, which guess what that means, y'all? It's in the Pepto drink family. Chug it up, kids.
Chug it up, kids.
We haven't had a Pepto drink in a long time. Not in this
episode. We have Kelly, we have Pepto Pink is a runner on our podcast. And
I've heard. It's a drinking game.
It's a drinking game. All right.
Oh, and we just came out with a special new Pepto drink merch, right?
We did. We just launched it. And we're going to model it for everyone very soon,
It's fantastic. I've already ordered mine.
I know, me too. Okay, when they get down there, it appears that Petrovich's shadow is reaching for a gun, so Lassiter turns and shoots him twice in the chest.
Oh, hang on, sorry. So you and I going in that shop in full tactical gear was, I still have an amazing picture of us out, or at least me anyway, out front of this great shot of...
No, we have it, yeah.
So we're in tactical gear. I'm in, still in my suit pants, for some reason, because he didn't go tactical pants. He can't go too hardcore. But that was...
We have our bulletproof. Yeah.
I just remember being on set with you that day and just us in our awesome vests and our guns and feeling super jacked up and cool.
I remember it really well. Maggie,
your vest seemed short.
It is a little short. I noticed that too, Kelly.
Yeah. I was like, oh my gosh. So what happens if someone shoots her in the stomach? I thought it was supposed to cover the whole thing and it looked like it was only a half vest. I was not happy about your protection.
Thank you, Kelly. I know. I noticed that as well. And I do remember there was some issue with like the sizing of these bulletproof vests. And it was like, if I went smaller, like it would fit better, more snug. But if I went to like where it fit longer, right, it looked like I was like in some kind of like pillow. Right. Not a tactical vest. I do remember there was a sizing issue. I have a very long torso, you guys, and it's a little weird sometimes. Yeah. I'm with you though, Tim. I loved that shot of us going in and the movement of our guns and like
the coolest. Like, clocking in as you turn the corner. Yeah. You guys.
We know how to dance together, you know?
It was exciting.
Okay, when they get down there, it appears that Petrovich's shadow is reaching for a gun. Yes. Then Lassiter shoots him in the chest. Then Lassiter goes to personally tell
again,
all of the families.
Again, I gotta say, Lassiter just discharging his weapon for no apparent reason at all. Like, he's such a bad cop in this episode. Like, not bad cop, but it's so against policy, everything he does in this episode.
Yeah.
Different time. You know, oddly enough, you guys had great gun training. Nobody on our writing staff had good gun training.
Procedure.
Make it look cool, you guys.
It's gotta be cool. Yeah. Someone's gotta shoot something. Yeah.
Okay. Lassiter personally tells, goes to personally tell all the families affected by Petrovich that he's gone for good. But Sean realizes that Petrovich had a scar on his hand and the shooter didn't. So the case is still on. As Lassie speaks to the press, yes. So
do we miss the bit where the boys, we say it's all clear and then no, there's no, I said there's nobody here. And then the boys come walking in behind us.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's a great line about how, James says he was hoping that Daniel Day-Lewis would be there.
The who?
Daniel Day-Lewis would be there because he wants his shoes fixed. And his line is, he cobbles, Gus. And you have this nod and a smile, which is hilarious.
So good.
And again, that's not written in the script.
No.
That O'Hara nods and agrees and smiles in agreement. But it was very fun. It was a very cute bit between the two of you.
No, I love that. As Lassie speaks to the press about catching the drug lord, Sean and Gus bet $50 to whoever can be on the camera the most. Lassiter yells, knock it off at them during his... oh my gosh, this was so funny, Tim.
Which in the press conference scene, when you all go back and rewatch, because it's a psych rewatch podcast, everyone. Oh, yeah. You got to look at the massive pea-sized rock of a zit over my left eyebrow. That took all the makeup they had on the trailer to cover up.
Oh my God. Oh,
it's
so
like
funny.
There's a small ball on my forehead.
I did.
Which is there for the
it.
Entire episode.
No, you know.
See, again, actors and vanity. That's the first thing I noticed.
James had one once that we had to digitally remove.
Oh, I definitely know I had a few that were like, guys, really? How will anyone be able to look at anything else in my close up?
Just so awkward.
That's why number one on the call sheet.
Number
one on the call sheet gets his blemish digitally removed. Lassiter does not.
Not so much. Not so much. Concealer.
They just
it was early on, Tim, when we had money and the network wanted to spend money, and it was before anything happened with you. So it wasn't about call sheet. It was about the fact that we were flush. And then all of a sudden it was like, yeah, we don't have the money.
Well, it was season four. We had to establish our handsome hero.
Okay, Juliet rushes in and tells Sean and Gus that Petrovich had actually died hours earlier from a drug overdose, and Sean jokes that Lassiter killed an already dead guy. Sean asks if there were signs of restraints on Petrovich's arms, and there was. So Sean realizes that Petrovich's killer and the shooter, the father of one of the kids who overdosed because of Petrovich, and the gang rushes off to save Lassiter. They arrive to see Lassiter at gunpoint by the father and the son's grave. You are so good
say,
in this scene, Tim.
Salamaccia is played by one of my favorite guest stars ever.
Ever.
The great Stephen Lang.
How good is he?
Or as he asked to be called, Slang.
Yeah, he likes to be called Slang. You're so both Slang so is, good in this scene.
So good.
He's such a tremendous actor, so he obviously raised Miguel.
Oh, Tim, I think you guys were right there for each other. And
oh,
it's like
thanks, man.
It's an emotional scene. It's like, I forgot the kind of intensity. And like, I was really nervous watching it. Like, what is about to happen? Oh, it was so good. He was great. I remember him so well. Okay. Salamaccia was upset because they only put Petrovich away.
Okay, got it.
Got it.
This is one of my favorite pictures on my phone.
Oh, yeah. So good.
So this picture of Stephen Lang holding behind me, holding a gun to my head, which normally would think that's not somebody you have a favorite, but it's because I'm in a scene with Stephen Lang.
Who is so good. I love the scene.
I
got to
go back about Slang. So, of course, I was a massive fan from Tombstone. Duh.
Right, right.
But prior to that, he played Colonel Pickett in Gettysburg. And he's just incredible in this movie.
He's so talented.
So I know, yeah, he's an incredibly talented actor. And there was a scene, I guess, he had to change shirts on this day. So he was kind of in a tent. And for some reason, I caught a glimpse of him shirtless. And,
okay.
Bring it.
I'll say it. I almost spilled my coffee because Stephen Lang is yoked, everybody. Like he's a.
cut like stone?
You heard it here first.
He's cut like stone. And I remember coming in, like, I was so just aghast at, and he was, I mean, Stephen had to be in his 60s at this time, just jacked, muscularly jacked. I remember making some kind of joke in my own insecurity, like, geez, Steve, you go to the gym today? And he stops, he gets dead serious. He goes, oh, I go to the gym every day.
Uh-huh.
It's like, of course you do.
Well,
and if you've seen, by the way, he's in that movie, Avatar, that little movie,
yeah,
Avatar.
That tiny movie.
And he couldn't join us today, only because we got Kelly. But he's on an international press junket for the the new movie coming out.
Avatar, yeah.
Wow.
So if you remember him in Avatar, he's yoked in that movie as well because he's plays a military guy. So that was not CGI. Like I would have had to have.
Stop it.
So that was the beginning of my legit man crush on Stephen Lang.
Yes. I love it. Salamaccio was upset because they only put Petrovich away on gun charges and he was already out so early. He wanted revenge on the broken system and for his son. Sean tried to channel his younger self, who had a perfect throwing arm once, and threw the office phone at the father. He totally missed, but distracted him long enough for Lassiter to break free and arrest the man.
Which, strangely, during this fight, Lassiter's cuffed. I don't know when I ever got... He must have, like, made me cuff myself in early part of the scene, because suddenly I'm like, I'm wearing handcuffs. That's how I kind of choked him.
Oh, that's right. But that line must have been cut, or something must have been cut. Why are you in handcuffs? Wait, did we see that? Kelly, did we see that?
They didn't see him catch him either.
Right. No.
You know what
that's
I mean?
True.
Like, so you, that's that true. Was all happened off screen. I can't imagine a Lassiter missing in a cafe shooting that many rounds, or someone getting the jump on him and cuffing him. Like, it stretched my believability.
No, because there's the shot where when I come up to Salamaccio and he's in the trunk of his car and he hands me a thing of flowers to distract me so my hands are full. He's carrying a little plastic bucket of flowers and gardening gear. And in that little bucket, we see a shot of he's got a gun.
Yes.
Cut to Lassiter having his back turned and he's got the jump on him.
Yeah.
There you go.
So Lassiter was a little off his game this episode.
Rightfully so. We had a guy after yips. Him. Exactly. The yips. It's had multiple characters. Kelly, that's why you're the genius. Okay. Sean then gets to meet with a sports psychologist to help him deliver a perfect strike. He did it. Sean is finally over his yips.
So I have a fun moment prior to this. Sorry. I think the boys are leaving after we realize it's Salamaccio.
Uh-huh.
They're giving a little background history on his character of how he's the dad of this kid who OD'd. But Gus is reading his file and he says he was also he was special ops, twice decorated Marine, which is why he was able to get the jump on Lassiter. But this brings us to a synchronistic moment, kids, which I've got a new phrase for it. I'm also going to call it a synchronipitous. Instead of serendipitous, it's a synchronipitous moment.
I like that.
So Slang was playing a twice decorated Marine, and Slang has a very popular, very successful one-man stage show where we travel all around New York, where he plays, it's all about Medal of Honor winners, where he chronicles the history of these famous Medal of Honors. They're not famous, but men who should be famous, who won the Medal of Honor. So...
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, that's a little interesting moment. That's a little quinky dink, synchronistic moment.
Love.
He's playing a character who's twice decorated, and he went on after our show to do this one man show about Medal of Honor winners, about decorated service members.
Wow,
that's my fun fact for the day.
Love that. I love that you know that. I didn't know that, and I love that he does that. What a beautiful thing. Well, that's it. That's kind of the end of our episode, guys. Oh, he then tells him to build Chief Vic and call it trauma therapy. Gus then mentions that once you can do one move, another is tainted. So Gus throws the ball at Sean and he gets the yips on that. Sean yells for the doctor to come back. It was a very, very cute ending to the
I got another Slang story.
Okay.
So while we were working with Steven that day,
we
basically said, look, here's the deal. You're going to come out with us tonight. We're going to buy you a steak and you're going to tell us stories. And he went, okay. So cut to James Dulé and Steve.
I sat next to him, by the way. Yes.
Yeah, cut to all of us at Joe Forte's and him.
Joe Forte's.
Chucking into a steak. It's like, oh, that's why he's so muscular, because he eats steak.
He also, I think he and Mel Damski were friends. I can't remember the history there, but I know that when we went to dinner, I felt like he and Mel knew each other or had some kind of, so. And Mel was always there anyway, but he was there that night. And I remember showing up, I think we were like coming from set, and it was like Mel and Slang sitting at this table. And I remember walking up and I was like, oh, that's Stephen Lang. We're having dinner with Stephen Lang.
I remember exactly what it was in Joe Forte's.
It was crazy. Yeah.
And he did. He was so game and he told us stories.
He was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Okay. We have fan questions. Kelly, do you have time for a few fan questions?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good.
Okay. Then I've got a Kelly question. So go ahead, fan questions.
We have fan. Well, we're fans, so we can also say that just falls into fan questions because we're fans of Kelly. All right. Did the cast ever play softball together?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we did. We had our own softball team. Absolutely.
And I got to sub. I got to sub for either one or two games. Somebody was out. And I remember James being like, I'm going to go play with the team. And I guess
I didn't hear you. Was this the Writers?
Yeah, Writers. The Writers had a softball team. And we went and played in like the valley somewhere.
And yeah, Park or something.
Yeah. And we played, I want to say like Parks and Rec Writers, or we played.
Yes.
I forget something. Yeah. I think it was. It was like so fun.
It was
and
great.
I got a hit.
It was great.
I remember.
Or was it
so
Scrubs? Was it Scrubs?
Oh, I don't. I don't know if the
I know
one
you played
I had
the Scrubs
was
Writers at one point.
Oh, I'm how curious! I was not invited to even sub in this game or even watch.
I think I don't know how I did. Actually,
do you have to understand a lot of us are intimidated by actors and thinking, why would they want to waste their time? And you know, now we know that you would have wanted to be a part of that.
Weird game.
Yeah.
So James was in a softball league, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
I think isn't that how that's how he and Jimmy became friends, I believe you said.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a softball league. I played in a softball league and like it was also a Writers kind of softball league, but it was a really random group of people. Not from like a specific show, but just like a bunch of people who got something together at those fields by Formosa, like the Formosa Cafe. Anyway, this is a long time.
Oh, off of La Cienega, maybe?
Yes.
Like that. Wilshire Park.
That'd be Plummer Park. Did you just say Plummer Park? Boom. We know our West Hollywood.
We know our West Hollywood.
Maggie, I feel like you would have played softball in high school.
I did. I played softball my whole life. I played softball until I like moved to LA. But yeah, I was a pitcher, believe it or not, and second base. Yeah, I loved it.
Wow.
Who was the best baseball player on the crew?
Todd Harthen.
Yes, Todd was so 100%. Good.
100%. James was excellent. But
James was very good too.
Todd was magic. Sorry.
Todd. That's
and
why
Sullivan.
I got to go.
Saladin was spectacular. He was fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I remember that too. Yeah, they're both really, really good. Okay.
You know, I feel really sad that the Writers didn't ask me to come play because baseball was the only sport I ever played in school.
Oh, damn it.
And,
we should have had you there. That would have been amazing.
There
was
a very pivotal moment in junior high when I had the choice of either going out for the baseball team or going out for the play.
Oh.
And I chose which one, guess?
Baseball.
Of course.
Put this way, baseball has wept ever since.
<They
should've.
laughs> Baseball has wept ever since.
I'll bet you are amazing.
So, I mean, they could have had an amazing catcher or center fielder.
Or you're tall. So is it first base?
Yeah.
They need that big stretch? I forget.
It could have been. They always had me behind the plate. Maybe that's why my crew didn't go further because they didn't have me in first base.
You should have been at first base.
I love it.
With that wingspan, I could have totally.
Why does Sean rep a number 44 when he wears a sports outfit? I'm going to take a guess. I don't know the answer to this for sure, but his birthday is April 4th, and that is 44. So I'm going to say maybe that's why that was his number.
And I know, isn't he a huge Titans fan?
Huge Titans fan.
Yeah, so there might have been a 44 there.
I was going to go with that.
Guy, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know. That I don't know the answer. So I'm guessing. I'm
Which,
like you.
And I believe, I could be wrong. I think he's a Titans fan because they originally were the Oilers when he was growing
Houston
up.
Houston Oilers, and he's from Texas.
Right, that's right.
And he followed them. That is correct. And he's a huge Titans fan. He's like tweets for them now. He's all over the place. I don't actually know the role that he plays, but I know he's like, very involved now with the team, which is so great.
Celebrity endorser.
Did any of the shirts from this episode fall off the truck?
God, no. I never wanted to wear that again.
I don't think so. Kelly, this one's for you.
Yeah.
How did Kelly get started in the TV biz and what led to Psych?
Wow. How did he get started in the television business? That's a really good question. I'm just trying to think of like going all the way back 1,000 years. Let's see how we remember getting started. My first job in TV was working at a company called Brillstein Gray, which was Bernie Brillstein and Brad Gray's company. And they did a Scary Shandling show, and they represented almost all the Saturday Night Live people. And I was working there, and I met an executive over at Fox and they offered me a job to come work in current programming. And current programming is an executive that covers shows that are currently in production. And so that was sort of my start, and I loved it. I loved current. It's what I do now. I work for DreamWorks, right. But overseeing a bunch of shows and being able to dip in and work with writers and talent. It's like my favorite thing in the whole world. So yeah, that was my
you're so good at start. It. And we sort of heard earlier how you got to Psych as well, which is like, we're so lucky. We're so lucky that it was you and Steve in that room together. And you were like, this I can do. This I can sell.
This I can sell.
Yeah.
It's a very commerce-driven business, but that idea of getting it out there. Who's going to buy this?
Dulé always says, we were talking about this. I saw him in Atlanta recently and Dulé's so smart. He's so smart because he fully understands the creative side. He fully understands the business side as well. And he really does. And so he always says it's like, it's show business. And there is this business side that when you step into show business, you also have to know and accept, even as a creative person, even creative types, you have to like go on, what sells. And it's sometimes I think hard for artists to totally accept, but like that's why we have people like you who can fully see both sides. You get the creatives, yeah. you are creative, but you also totally see and get the business side, and you have that like that intuition to know this is what will sell. Yeah,
and yet our family is the exception to the rule of it's not called show friends, it's called show business.
Right.
Yeah.
But it was great. Yeah. And we're not just show friends. Like, obviously, we've gone from show family to incredible friends, our whole group.
Yeah.
Including Miss Kelly Kolchak.
I think what's interesting is that, and this is, to me, the secret sauce of Dulé Hill. It is the absolute genius behind that man. And I'm just like the biggest fan of Dulé Hill. Like, this whole thing, I just geek out at all of you because you're just so incredibly talented. Dulé is an amazing listener. But he's not just a good listener. He is studying and learning from you when you talk. When I would be on set with Dulé, he was so interested in how are the numbers doing? Where are we at? Like, but it wasn't just like, oh, you must know about the numbers of my show. How are we doing? It was literally like he wanted to learn about that. He loved looking at those numbers and those reports and whatever. But he's very quiet about it, which I think is just like, that's just his magic. He's an absolute student. He comes to everything.
He's a quiet genius.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she's a quiet genius.
He really, really, really is.
Yeah.
All right. What is the weirdest exercise motivation technique you tried? I mean, I think I definitely have once had like the personal trainer that just like kind of beats you up emotionally a little bit. It didn't work that well for me. The ones
getting
that are just
at?
Like, a little bit, yeah. No, and like kind of really, really pushing you in the ways that you're like, I need to be pushed like this. And you're like, I don't know if I need to be pushed exactly.
I want to be loved. Just love me.
just say nice things and then I'm doing a good job. Anyway, I don't know. What weird motivation techniques have either of you tried?
I'd say try in the 90s or the late 80s, early 90s, various, somewhere in there. Working the counter at Johnny Rockets on Melrose on a weekend.
Oh my gosh, that's a good motivation.
And just desperately wanting to get out of waiting tables. That's pretty
true.
Good motivator.
That's true. Just think about, are you disappointing your mom? That's what that would be it for me. Would this disappoint her?
That's good motivation, Kelly.
Harder. Yeah.
Tim, what did you want to ask? Those are all of our fan questions.
So okay, I want to keep in the new segment I came up with that John Ross Bowie came up with, our dear friend.
Yes.
Kelly Kolchak, what is your favorite Sutton Place celebrity sighting?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, what? But she started our show, but I saw her there before she started our show, Jane Lynch. I was just a huge, huge fan of Jane Lynch to see her in the lobby. I geeked out. I totally geeked out.
Yeah, I love it. And she did our show. Yeah. Guys, that is our Sean Gets the Yips episode with our very, very special, wonderful, true family member guest, Kelly Kolchak. Who I know everyone has just been hearing so much about you because all of our episodes have people mention you all the time. So now we're actually getting to talk to you, and I feel like we should have you back because you have so many of the other side of the of what we're doing. You have the network, you have the notes, you have all the inside scoop of what's going on that on in that way.
And you're just an amazing, awesome person. We love you.
And you're just an amazing person, and we love you.
And I'm really glad we finally got one of the female executive producers represented on the show.
Yeah.
I have to tell you this. You know, I work with a lot of very young people who are passionate artists and amazing writers and all of this. And I have to tell you, they lose their minds when they find out that I had anything to do with Psych. And I have to tell you guys, they grew up with this show. The show has gotten them through some really hard times. They got them through COVID. They look at it as, you know, we talk about us being family, but they look at it as their family. They own this show. What you guys have done and what you've put out there and the joy that you have given people, because you are the face of Psych. You know, we can talk about working behind the scenes. They love you. They love this show. What you have put out there, the joy that you have given. I mean, it's such a gift. And I'm just so, so honored that you asked me to come be a part of the show. And I had to tell you just how much I hear the love and admiration and passion that people have for this series. And so much of it goes to you guys. So it's just so great to see you.
We wouldn't have had that without your, great leadership.
You saw all of this before we did. You know, you saw it, you had it, you saw Steve Franks, you saw this idea, you knew, you signed off on everybody, you knew when something wasn't working, you fixed it. Like, you know, you guys, it was the whole team. And I feel like, as, you know, we talk about Steve, but like, I feel like you and Steve were such a team, and Chris from the very beginning with this like no a-hole policy, keeping a certain vibe, you know, so it started there, and we just got so lucky. Yeah.
So Kelly, there's something about you and the nature of your demeanor as a human being that if any of us ever had a problem, we all felt safe ever, like just a life problem, we could come to you and you would be mama bear and take care of us.
Always.
Also such a mama bear that she was intuitive to know sometimes when stuff was going on, even like before we were totally even approaching it or getting there yet. I mean, I know you, would see, I remember you coming to me a couple of times and being like, hey, you know, I see what's going on here. And I'd be like, damn it, really? Or something. And like, you would know, you knew even before I did. And it made it, yes, as Tim said, like, we always felt safe. We were just such a family. We could talk about anything. And that started with you guys. And
well, remember, television is a team sport. That's what everybody has to realize. Nobody can do TV without everyone. I mean, think about it. This show had to be all of us pulling together. And the fish stinks from the head for sure, you know? And, you know, Steve brought the joy, and James and you guys just like embraced it. And that set was a joyous place to be, you know? And seeing you is such an elixir. And I know that this show does so much good for so many people. What a great treat to get behind the scenes of this delightful show that you guys were such an incredible part of.
This and that so set family. Would not have been such a joyful place with like people like you and Steve and Chris showing us the way to go.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned the part about people saying how, I mean, Tim and I just did a convention in Salt Lake City, and I would say that the majority of, I mean, it's a couple months ago now, but like the majority of the stories were, yes, there were fans, but not just like, hey, we love the show. It was like our family binged this during COVID together. There were new people coming to it. There were people who have known it for decades, you know, for as long as we've been on. Like, it's sort of like this show keeps finding new life and takes on different forms because it does have that kind of joy and the lightness and all of that. I saw someone post something the other day, you know, and I don't even think I realized it at the time, that was after Mystery Inn Presents. It's the premiere of the next season. And I'm like working off somewhere just because of my hair is darker. And it's like, because I went through this traumatic experience, but like we addressed that in a comedra on a show. And somebody said, like, I love that I can watch the joy in this show, but then also like the real moments that happen are also taken seriously. And they're not just like, you know, brushed over. And I don't know. I was like, man, these you writers and the stories and like all of it. We are so lucky.
I mean, and the number of people like my friends Mark and Christy who reached out and said how this show in particular has helped them all, helped their families get through things like chemo and Alzheimer's and just all the all the hard stuff in life.
Yeah.
The fact that we are all lucky enough to have been part of something that makes that brings people joy and makes their lives easier, in addition to it gives them some laughs and entertains them, is not lost on any of us.
Right.
Yeah.
Believe you me, psychos.
We love you, psychos. We love you, Kelly.
Love you, Tim and Maggie.
And we're gonna have you back, and we can't thank you enough for you know, bringing all this to its joyful light.
I did say joyful a lot, but I meant it.
But that's you. You are naturally that way, as people will hear on this episode, even who don't know you. Like that's Kelly.
And Kelly, do not change your beautiful silver hair. It looks fantastic on you.
I'm so jealous.
I
mean it.
Thank you. I'm gonna carry these compliments with me for the rest of the day. You've made me filled my soul.
You've made us that way. You've made us feel that way too.
Hey, what are we doing January 21st?
Oh, we should mention this. We just announced it, which we can talk about even more. We are doing a San Francisco Sketch Fest. We are so freaking excited.
Go to the Sketch Fest website, everybody. Sketchfest.com, I assume it is.
Get your tickets.
And you can come see us live. Do our thing.
Yes, please.
Sounds amazing.
We're very excited to get to do this in front of a live, I almost said studio audience.
A
live venue audience.
Yeah. We can't wait.
And we'll talk about our dear friend of the show, Jenna Varney, to thank for that. Jenna, who founded Sketchfest many years ago.
We're so excited.
And invited us to come up during that horrible year of 2020.
Yeah. We were supposed to do it then. So we're finally getting to do it, which is so fun.
Thanks to all of you still listening and making us a popular podcast. The finest podcast of all Rewatch podcasts out there, if I do say so myself.
Good. I agree. Love you guys. Kelly, thank you so much for being here. And we'll have you back anytime you want. Bye.
Bye.
This was such a fun episode. Thank you so much, Kelly, for coming on the pod. And as always, thank you all for listening to The Psychologists Are In. We love you so much. Don't forget to follow us on our Instagram at The Psychologists Are In and our Twitter at Psychologist Pod. And check out our Patreon for full videos of the episodes and more at patreon.com/psychologistsarein. Oh, and if you are in the San Francisco area, please check us out at Sketchfest on January 21st. We will see you next week, where we will talk about season 4, episode 6, Bollywood Homicide, with the one and only Sendhil Ramamurthy.
This is The Confused Breakfast,
a movie podcast creating a lot of ruckus around the world.
We talk about classic movies the same way that you and your friends talk about them,
with a little bit of film buff knowledge thrown in because we just can't help ourselves.
If movie quotes are part of your daily vocabulary,
if you like to talk about fun fan theories,
if you've always wanted to punch a movie character in the face,
we're here to podcast for you.
From Back to the Future,
Ghostbusters,
The Shining, and so many more.
Check out The Confused Breakfast wherever you listen to podcasts.